Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni. Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection. There's more in the Sunday Gospel than meets the eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus looked up to heaven and said, I do not pray for my disciples alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their word, that all may be one. As you, Father, are in me and I in you, I pray that they may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. I have given them the glory you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I living in them, you living in me, that their unity may be complete. So shall the world know that you sent me, and that you love them as you love me. Father, all those you gave me I would have in my company where I am, to see this glory of mine, which is your gift to me, because of the love you bore me before the world began. Just, Father, the world has not known you, but I have known you, and these have known you that sent me. To them I have revealed your name, and I will continue to reveal it, so that your love for me may live in them, and I may live in them.
Although between last Sunday and today the Feast of the Ascension has been celebrated, the Easter season is not over yet. The Paschal candle, image of the risen Lord, is still in the sanctuary to remind us that the 50 days from Easter to Pentecost are one feast day, and that the glorified Christ is still present in his community. So the revised liturgy has returned us to the ancient tradition of joyous thanksgiving and frequent alleluias. And if we read Luke's account of the Ascension, we find that after Jesus was carried up into heaven, they worshipped him, and then went back to Jerusalem full of joy, and they were continually in the temple praising God. Jesus has been taken up to heaven then, but the apostles are no longer sad, and in the Acts we may read that when they got back from the Mount of Olives, where it is believed he ascended to heaven, they went to the upper room where they were staying. And our gospel today is set once more in that upper room, at that momentous Last Supper, just before Jesus and his disciples leave for the Garden of Gethsemane. The passage we have heard is the last part of what is known as the High Priestly Prayer of Jesus, a title said to have originated with St. Cyril of Alexandria, 5th century doctor of the Church. It's the prayer with which Jesus ended the Last Supper. A note by one scholar reads,
one of the most beautiful passages in the Gospel, it's the longest outpouring of the Son to the Father, and at the same time the loftiest revelation of himself given by Jesus.
After praying for himself, Jesus prays for his disciples, and then for those who will believe in him through the word of those disciples. May they all be one. And the same scholar comments,
the last petition of Jesus' prayer is that all those who believe in him, the Christians, may forever remain deeply united in the love of God. For this reason, this last section is generally called the Prayer for Unity.
And as he prays, writes another scholar, Jesus looks across the centuries, addressing also those who will believe in him on the basis of the announcement of the first witnesses. As he looked, did he also see the divisions among Christians the centuries would bring? Divisions between East and West, and at the Reformation between the peoples of Europe. But men of goodwill have always struggled to heal the divisions, and in our own time, the ecumenical movement has produced a climate change, though the goal is still distant. The road to unity will indeed be long and difficult, declared the leader of the Anglican delegation to Pope Paul VI at the end of the Second Vatican Council. But he also said, we believe that the days of mutual fear, of rigid exclusiveness, and of arrogant self-sufficiency on either side are passing away. That statement was made at an evening prayer service for promoting Christian unity, conducted by Pope Paul in the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls on December the 4th, 1965. And in the Council's decree on ecumenism, we may read,
Little by little, as the obstacles to perfect ecclesial communion are overcome, all Christians will be gathered, in a common celebration of the Eucharist, into that unity of the one and only Church which Christ bestowed on his Church from the beginning.
A heartfelt longing for this moment is expressed in this prayer, taken from a book of prayers written by a Catholic priest and a lecturer at an Anglican theological college.
Lord, I feel very deeply my separation from other Christians when I attend their Eucharist and cannot receive communion. Why must we be so cut off from each other at the moment when we should be sharing you? This should be the time when we are closest together. But it's now that I know most deeply the agony of separation. Lord, if it breaks my heart in this way, how much more must it break yours? We love each other and we love you. Why must we be separated at this feast of love and union? Lord, make it possible for us to worship together in complete union and fellowship, and show us what we must do to bring this about.
And back in the 9th century, St. Dionysius, patriarch of the Syrian Jacobite Church, wrote this prayer for unity among Christians.
O God the Father, origin of divinity, good that is beyond all that is good, fair beyond all that is fair, in whom is calmness, peace, and concord. Do thou make up the dissensions which divide us from each other, and bring us back to a unity of love, which may bear some likeness to thy divine nature. And as thou art above all things, make us one, by the unanimity of a good mind, that through the embrace of charity and the bonds of affection, we may be spiritually one, as well in ourselves as in each other, through that peace of thine which maketh all things peaceful, and through the grace, the mercy, the tenderness of thy Son, Jesus Christ.
A living witness of this active search for unity is the ecumenical community of Thésée in France, founded in 1944 by Brother Roger Schütz, to be an existential sign of the unity of the Church.
Never resign yourself to the scandal of the separation of Christians, all so readily professing love for their neighbour, yet remaining divided. Make the unity of Christ's body your passionate concern.
So writes Brother Roger Schütz. And this is exactly what the Brothers of Thésée do. Coming from different Christian denominations, Catholic, Protestant and others, they live, work and pray together. And in an address to the brothers while on a visit to Thésée, Pope John Paul II has said,
Because of your passion for the reconciliation of all Christians in a full communion, because of your love for the Church, you will be instrumental in making sure that the effort desired by Christ to recover the visible unity of his body in the full communion of one same faith never slackens.
One word which stands out for me in our Gospel today is not perhaps immediately obvious as a spur to unity, and yet our Lord said,
I have given them the glory you gave me, that they may be one as we are one.
And into my mind came those words of Isaiah, transmuted in the music of Handel's Messiah. But in a strange process of what I can only call wishful thinking, what I heard when I put on Messiah were these words, And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all men shall sit together. The words, of course, are, And all men shall see it together. Or in the other versions, all mankind or all flesh shall see it. Still, with unity in mind, it was, I think, a happy mistake. And glory? Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but to thy name give glory, ran the old version of the psalm, which today reads, Not by us, Yahweh, not by us, by you alone is glory deserved. But what is the glory of God? For the Israelites, it was contained in the Ark of the Covenant, for there God was present. And when the Ark was captured by the Philistines, a child was born whom his mother named Ichabod, because she said, The glory is departed from Israel. For Ichabod is Hebrew, for where is the glory? In an old dictionary, I found two definitions. The first reads,
The glory of God, the majesty and splendour attendant upon a manifestation of God.
And Epiphany comes immediately to mind, and that invitation by Isaiah.
Arise, shine out, for your light has come. The glory of the Lord is rising on you, though night still covers the earth and darkness the peoples. Above you the Lord now rises, and above you his glory appears. The nations come to your light, and kings to your dawning brightness.
Brightness and glory seem synonymous when referred to God, as St. John writes in his Apocalypse.
Jerusalem, the holy city, had all the radiant glory of God. The city did not need the sun or the moon for light, since it was lit by the radiant glory of God and the Lamb was lighted torch for it.
And the same image appears in the letter to the Hebrews.
God in our own time has spoken to us through his Son, the radiant light of God's glory.
All through the scriptures we find references to God's glory as something bright and shining. The shepherds on the hills above Bethlehem were dazzled by it.
And the glory of the Lord shone about them, and they were sore afraid.
And then the multitude of the heavenly host fills the night with their exultation, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest," words which we echo in our Sunday Mass. But the glory is not ours to keep, not yet, and its light is sometimes as distant as those stars millions of years away. When the poet Henry Vaughan wrote his Ascension hymn, he was sitting alone at midnight thinking of departed friends and mourning not so much for them as for himself. "They are all gone into the world of light," he begins enviously, and later exclaims,
"I see them walking in an air of glory, whose light doth trample on my days which are at best but dull and hoary, mere glimmering and decays."
Between the glory of God and the glory of man is an unsurmountable abyss. In his first letter, Peter quotes Isaiah when he writes,
"All flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man as the flower of grass."
But in our childhood and youth, it seems, we're given a glimpse of the glory of God before it fades into mere glimmering and decays. William Wordsworth expressed the concept powerfully in his great ode, Intimations of Immortality from Recollections of Early Childhood.
There was a time when meadow, grove and stream, the earth and every common sight, to me did seem apparelled in celestial light, the glory and the freshness of a dream. It is not now as it hath been of yore. Turn wheresoever I may, by night or day, the things which I have seen, I now can see no more.
Comments one critic, as the poem opens, the vision of the earth we know is bathed in a divine radiance of light. But the mature man realizes that something precious has gone from his life.
But yet I know, where'er I go, that there hath passed away a glory from the earth. Whither is fled the visionary gleam? Where is it now, the glory in the dream?
Wordsworth believed in the immortal soul, and while wondering why it was that, with the passing of the years, the glory which had transfigured all things for him in boyhood had fled, and he no longer saw the earth apparelled in celestial light, yet he believed, as the critic writes, that man must learn through his suffering heart and his thinking mind another way into the abiding world of the spirit.
What though the radiance that was once so bright be now forever taken from my sight? Though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. In the soothing thoughts that spring out of human suffering, in the faith that looks through death, in years that bring the philosophic mind.
Age does not always bring wisdom, nor to everyone is given the philosophic mind. And what of those who do not share Wordsworth's belief in immortality? One of these was Edward Thomas, whose vision of glory was marred by these great unanswered questions.
The glory of the beauty of the morning, the cuckoo crying over the untouched dew, the blackbird that has found it, and the dove that tempts me on to something sweeter than love. White clouds ranged even and fair as new-mown hay, the heat, the stir, the sublime vacancy of sky and meadow and forest and my own heart. The glory invites me, yet it leaves me scorning all I can ever do, all I can be, beside the lovely motion, shape and hue, the happiness I fancy fit to dwell in beauty's presence. Shall I now this day begin to seek as far as heaven, as hell, wisdom or strength to match this beauty? Start and tread the pale dust pitted with small dark drops, in hope to find whatever it is I seek, hearkening to short-lived, happy-seeming things that we know naught of in the hazel copse? Or must I be content with discontent, as larks and swallows are perhaps with wings? And shall I ask at the day's end once more what beauty is, and what I can have meant by happiness? And shall I let all go, glad, weary, or both? Or shall I perhaps know that I was happy oft and oft before, a while forgetting how I am fast pent, how dreary swift with naught to travel to is time? I cannot bite the day to the core.
Agnostic he may have been, but Thomas was expressing that well-known feeling of divine discontent common to every human being and of which every sensitive soul is aware. And what of that second definition of the glory of God? It ran:
the honour of God considered as the final cause of creation and as the highest moral aim of intelligent creatures.
Now that's some definition. And St. Paul shows us how to achieve it.
Whether you eat or drink, or whatever else you do, do all to the glory of God.
And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all men shall see it together.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now on to something quite different. Today, May the 16th, the Church celebrates World Communications Day. It's the only worldwide celebration called for by the Second Vatican Council, and it's celebrated in most countries on the Sunday before Pentecost. The announcement of the theme is made on September the 29th, the feast of the archangels Michael, Raphael and Gabriel, who is the patron of those who work in radio. The Pope's message for World Communications Day is traditionally published in conjunction with the memorial of St. Francis de Sales, patron of writers, in January. This is to allow bishops' conferences and diocesan offices sufficient time to prepare audiovisual and other materials for national and local celebrations. Every year, World Communications Day has a different theme. The theme chosen this year is the priest and the pastoral ministry in a digital world, new media at the service of the word. Philippa Hitchens spoke to Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. First of all, she asked him, why choose this particular theme?
The choice of the theme was, I suppose, partly related to the fact that we are celebrating the Year of the Priest. It was also a logical development in the sense of our message of the previous year, which had spoken about the potential of new media to support the work of evangelization. So this year, although it's a letter addressed to priests, it's also a letter really that is focusing on the role of evangelization and new media in the church in general. But as I say, it's looking on the priest as somebody who has a particularly important role in that task of evangelization, and saying to priests, think about new media and how they can enhance your ministry. It's not necessarily saying you have to go out there and become an expert in new media or you have to become an expert in new technology, but particularly you may find in your parish people who are very skilled in the new media who can use those new media to help you maybe to reach a bigger audience, to think about people who can't come to church, to develop maybe ways of communication that they can use to develop podcasts working with your homilies, or in some cases we've seen very interesting little video collages done with homily materials and with celebrations and with musical celebrations in church that can then create a sense of connection on a broader platform. So what we were doing is in a sense inviting priests to think about how sometimes with very little extra effort it can add a huge new dimension to work they're already doing, to important work. Now, it's not that every priest is going to be producing homilies that will be automatically of significance to the whole world, but a group of priests working together over a season like Lent could work on a very good series of homilies that then can become maybe a series of podcasts on a diocesan website that could become shared with other places. And it's been interesting to see the reaction, particularly in the English-speaking world, that a number of the kind of magazines and reviews that are addressed to priests have taken up the theme. And what they've done is gathered examples from various priests saying, well, I've tried this, it did work or it didn't work, or I've tried the other and it did or didn't work, or I worked with my parish pastoral team and we developed the following thing. So I think what it has done is heightened for priests an awareness of this important new world, of knowing that they shouldn't feel that they're strangers there, and of knowing that the help and support is available to help them to move into that world.
As far as you and your council here are concerned, it's not really an option anymore, is it, this kind of outreach into the digital world? It's more of a necessity.
It's absolutely a necessity. It's something that, in a sense, if you're thinking about the potential audiences you can reach, then to turn your back on this potential forum, this potential world, is short-sighted. A very clear one, as we listened to a presentation recently by Helen Osman, who's the Director of Communications Department at the USCCB, the American Bishops' Conference. And she said, I'm going to talk not so much as a director of communications, but as a mother of four children aged between 20 and 30. And she said their social life is built around their Facebook connections. I suppose in the States, where it's a very mobile society, that's... And she said, if the church isn't going to be present in their world of social connections, it's just not going to be present. Now, it's not that that's their only way of form of presence, but I think one of the things we'd be very conscious of, we can use the new media to knock on doors and to invite people into a different form of relationship. But even if we're not present, it's saying something already. Okay, we want to be present as effectively and as professionally as possible, but even at the beginning, it's just important to get something in there that gets us started and says we're aware of this world, we care about this world, and we want to be part of the dialogue that's emerging.
It has been a bit of a late start, if you like, in a way, hasn't it? Is the church really catching up, do you think, with this?
I don't think it's been that late. I think if you were to say as a centralised response, maybe it is a little late. But if you were to say from the beginning, there have been huge initiatives taken by individual priests and religious and parish communities that have developed along the way. So you had things like the Sacred Space website of the Irish Jesuits that's now multilingual, that's been there from very early days on the web. You've had people podcasting from the very beginning. And I think maybe one of the things we're learning is this is a bottom-up world of communications. And maybe the mistake would have been to have had one master plan that was going to do everything and might have fallen flat on its face, which was the experience of many of the large commercial companies who put huge money into new media strategies that fell flat on their faces. What we're saying is let the great things happen that are happening across the globe at various levels, depending on the competencies and the capacities of various conferences and individual priests. Let's step back and see what's working, what's not working, and learn from that. And we grow it from the bottom up, waiting to see what matures and what doesn't. So I think probably the church, in its broadest sense, has been there right from the beginning. And it may be better that at the more central level, we wait and respond and then develop an appropriate response that coordinates all these different efforts.
The tone of the Pope's message is very positive, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yet there are huge challenges inherent in these new medias, the need not to be exploited, the need to respond to interactive communications and so on. They must be a great concern to you too, though.
I mean, there are a range of concerns. I think what's been clear from the message this year and from the message the previous year is the Pope is saying, let's not be naive. He names some of the difficulties, but he's saying, let's focus on the positive. I think that's very often the way with the internet. You can try and think of, it's going to be there. It's developing. There are all sorts of problems there. There's all sorts of material there that none of us would like and that is damaging and harmful and disrespectful of people and the dignity of people in all sorts of ways. We could step back from it all and just lament it, or we can think about trying to fill it up with an alternative of offering people life-giving materials, offering people resources that strengthen them and strengthen them in their resolves to resist the less desirable material. So I think our choices is like any marketplace. We go in there, we try to be present. The church has never hesitated to be present in the world with all the ambiguities that that involves. So I think that is one thing. I think it's very clear that the Pope is also saying to priests is, look, be there precisely as priests. Don't go in there just because you're technically interested in material. Don't become a kind of a techie just for the sake of being a techie, but to see it as a world that is available to you and where you can participate. So I think no more than in the message the previous year where the Pope was very clear that the most fundamental irony of all would be if the new technologies which are there to promote communication ended up blocking communications and becoming a place where people just lose themselves and lose contacts with others would be a real tragedy and an irony.
Being present in a very effective way in these new medias also requires the church to develop a new kind of language, doesn't it? A more accessible language.
Yeah, it's very clear that the language, if you visit many of the websites of diocese, and congratulations first to the diocese for taking these initiatives, but much of the content is textual. And some of it's very good textual commentary. So great homilies, great sermons, great speeches. But one of the problems is if you're thinking about somebody who's just browsing around, who's playing around, who's following links, who may stumble across your site, you need something more immediately grabbing if you're to get that person's attention. And I think that's one of the things we have to look at is the use of sound, the use of images, the combination of that with text in order to capture attention. And then maybe having got the attention, you invite the person into a deeper type of reality. And one of the things that's very clear is, I mean, we all know that as a church, we have a very precise theological language. We also have our own, what some people would call Vaticanese, which, you know, one learns to read, but it's not immediately obvious to all people, even all very favourably disposed people, how they can read certain of our documents. So I think one of the things we have to learn is we need to have that kind of entry-level language, a language that draws the person in. Doesn't mean we abandon all the other languages. One of the things I've been saying recently is that the church must be multilingual. We must speak the deep language of the liturgy. We can't abandon the precise language of theology, but equally we need a language that invites people in, that is more textual, that is textual, but is also more visual and more drawing on sound. And one analogy, I think people talk sometimes about this being a post-literate age. In the pre-literate age, we did very well. We used music, we used stained glass windows. It's not beyond our resources to come up with a form of language that draws people in. And that doesn't mean we abandon the other languages. Also, we have to recognise the experience of all of us. If you're learning a new language, you make mistakes. If you're not willing to make mistakes, then you don't learn the language. It's worth risking a few mistakes in the effort to communicate with a bigger and larger world.
Thanks to Philippa Hitchin, speaking there to Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. That's all from the English feature programme today, but we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.